Hello, and welcome to Marketing Room 101, where I invite marketers from all corners of the industry to banish one thing forever. I'm Ben Norman, your host and self-appointed guardian of Room 101. Now, I'm joined in this, the first ever episode, by Paul Feldwick, and I was delighted to be able to have Paul as my first ever guest because the work he's done influences what I do day in, day out. When I read his second book, Why Does the Peddler Sing, a few years ago, it felt like everything I felt was true and wanted to be true about what makes great advertising, but had somehow been lost down the line, was true after all, but that I now had the meat to put on the bones and the rationale to sell entertaining, fame-building ideas, both amongst colleagues and to clients. So here's my conversation with the endlessly insightful and incredibly experienced Paul Feldwick. Paul, welcome to Marketing Room 101. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Paul, before we get stuck in, for the benefit of our listeners, would you mind describing the room, please? What do you see in here?
I think the image that comes to mind immediately for Marketing Room 101 is literally a meeting room where a large number of people are sitting around a table and many of them are staring at their laptops, and there is a PowerPoint presentation at one end of the room, and there's somebody standing there talking about it, and half of the people in the room are ignoring it because they're getting on with their work, because this is the only time they possibly can get any work done. And everybody else is sort of vaguely doing their best to engage with it and is asking helpful questions and saying things like, building on that, I think you're talking complete rubbish. And they're basically engaged in some mammoth intellectual task that has already taken them 18 months and will take them another 18 months before there's a change of management and the whole thing becomes redundant and they move on to something else. And I won't name the company involved, but you can possibly have a guess at which one it might be.
So you've joined me today because you brought something to submit to Marketing Room 101. Before we do that, I wanted to indulge, if it's okay, in a tiny bit of hero worship, because for me, this is quite a big deal. I did a quick calculation the other day, and in recent years, I've forced 5 different marketing books on other people that I've worked with. Some like that, some maybe not, but either way, I've forced those books on those people. And they are, for one reason or another, Why Does the Peddler Sing? By yourself. Influence by Robert Cialdini. How Brands Grow by Byron Sharp. Choice Factory by Richard Shotton. And finally, The Art of Client Service by Robert Solomon. I wanted you to try and have a little guess at which I've given out the most times.
Oh, well, it would be very sort of immodest of me to suggest that it could ever possibly have been mine. But I wonder if that's where your question is going.
Yeah, it's actually joint. I've given out your book and How Brands Grow 5 times. I've given out The Art of Client Service 4 and the other 2 twice
each. I'm really impressed, thank you, and honoured and flattered and so forth. And the other books, I don't know the Solomon book, but I know the others. Mm. And yes, I'm proud to be in that company. And actually, I'd like to say that I think, although Byron wouldn't necessarily agree because it's very difficult to find anything that I can actually agree with Byron Sharp on, apart from the fact that I agree with him on most things, that, you know, I think those two books go very well together. I think
Agreed.
His sort of scientific measured approach and his academic approach provides some useful covering fire for a lot of the things that I'm saying, and his notion of mental availability is a really crucial sort of building block for my notion of fame. So I think people who read How Brands Grow and say, especially the advertising chapter, and say, well, you know, what is creative publicity? You know, what do you mean by that? At which point I can hear the late Andrew Ehrenberg saying, ha, 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 that's not my job to tell you that, you know, ask your advertising agency. At that point, yeah. I think people should go and read Why Does the Peddler Sing? Because it's my attempt to answer that question and fill that gap.
I guess to save me spending the next 30 minutes trying to explain your ideas to people, I wondered if you could just maybe give, before we get into what you've brought with you, what would you say is the idea at the heart of Why Does the Peddler Sing? And also Anatomy of Humbug.
Well, I mean, I think there's more than one idea. But to try and make it very simple, I mean, Why Does the Peddler Sing? I suppose the crucial thing that started me going was I worked in an agency for many years where we did advertising that was very popular, very entertaining, and often very silly, sometimes sentimental. But, you know, we had talking animals and cartoons, and a lot of marketing people can easily see as very childish, vulgar stuff. And indeed, many of the public like to see it as that as well. And yet, we sort of knew that was what worked. But all the time I was there, I don't think we really ever understood why it worked. And we sort of vaguely said, it gets attention and it makes it more memorable. But we still thought it was all about, you know, it's a way of communicating a sales message about why the product is better. And after I left the business and continued to reflect on it and, you know, write about it and talk about it, it seemed to me more and more that we had missed the point throughout, that actually so much advertising, especially brand building advertising, while it may on the surface appear to be saying something about the product, it's often not saying anything very important or significant or interesting about the product. It's working through a completely different mechanism. And that mechanism is about entertainment, for want of a better word. And I think that's where Byron Scholl's idea of mental availability then sort of dovetailed with that. I said, well, perhaps the whole thing that is going on is we are doing all these things in order to create those mental connections, those mental networks of memory and association, which mean that people are more likely to think of the brand in more and more situations, and that makes them more likely to buy it. And then I built on that, and I built on that, and I thought, well, actually, it's more than just that as well. Mental availability is something that goes on in a single brain, but actually, what popular famous advertising does is it creates something cultural and social as well. And that is something that's happening in millions of brains and between millions of people. It's not just happening as a psychological event. So
yeah,
this is a very simple theory of advertising in many ways. Perhaps one of the reasons is that the ad industry for many years rejected it is because it sounds too simple, and they wanted to be doing something rather grander and more rational and more intellectual. But actually, this is what boils down to. And it led me back to saying, well, actually, there's a long history of this. The history goes back to showmanship in the 19th century with people like P.T. Barnum or the traveling medicine shows. And probably it goes back even further than that. It goes back to the Middle Ages and any society in which you've had traveling peddlers who go around selling things. And in order to sell things, they sing songs, do acrobatics, tell jokes, wear funny costumes, whatever it is that kind of builds that relationship, gets them talked about, gets them noticed. Gets them remembered, makes them distinctive. So that, if you like, is the theme of Why Does the Peddler Sing? And I don't remember reading any of that anywhere else. So I wrote the book because it seemed to me nobody else had quite said it that way.
So without further ado, you are here today because you want to submit something from our industry into the eternal abyss. So I wanted to know, what is it you've brought in? What would you like to remove forever?
Well, to put it in a single phrase, I'd like to consign to Room 101 the notorious brand onion. When I say the brand onion, though, I mean, which has been much ridiculed and is almost a sort of a slightly mythical beast in a way, because although if you look up brand onion, you'll find thousands of examples of brand onions online, I've never actually been able to track down who, if anyone, quite invented it or where it came from. But it stands for a much broader category of things which are actually ubiquitous, and which I've sort of described as ways of trying to describe a brand's essence. And this whole idea that a brand has an essence, or that every strong brand is built around a single idea, and we don't even need to get into the debate about purpose, but purpose for me is a subset of this thinking as well. Mm. You know, that every brand is based on some idea. And there are lots of brand strategy consultants around who are endlessly on LinkedIn rehearsing their examples of what they think that big single idea behind Nike or Apple or, you know, or McDonald's or whatever it is. And I have to confess, you know, while I'm sort of going to be critical of this, I spent many years of my life doing exactly the same thing. When I was at DDB, we spent a long time developing our own patent version, which we called Brand Foundations. And it was very similar to a lot of the others. It was similar to the Unilever brand key and the brand pyramid that Keller came up with and all this other stuff. And they all do more or less the same thing, which is they are trying to sum up in a sort of abstract and theoretical way what a brand is about. And this is then meant to provide a sort of template or sense of direction which guides everything that the brand does. Now, I think this way of thinking is very, very widely believed. And it's certainly very widely talked about, and it's taught in business schools and elsewhere. And as I say, it's plausible enough and attractive enough as an idea that I myself got very involved in it over a long period of time. The reason I've sort of moved away from that way of thinking, it sort of starts very simply from the fact that I don't think I've ever actually seen it work in practice. Now, I mean, if somebody can find an example, that's fine. If you can make it work for you, I can't possibly knock it. But what we actually see and hear about virtually all the time is not a story of this is how we did something and it helped the brand. What we are hearing is post-rationalization of here is a brand that has been successful and here is what we think is the idea that was behind it. Now, in Why Does the Peddler Sing, I actually take Coca-Cola as a very specific example of this, and I spell out in a lot of detail what I think the history of Coca-Cola actually was. And I mean, I've read a lot about the history of Coca-Cola and I've thought a lot about the brand. I so far have not found at any point in that brand's history that anybody had anything remotely like a brand onion or a brand key or a brand anything else or a brand sausage or whatever it was. But in fact, the history of Coca-Cola, clearly one of the most successful, largest and longest lived brands that we are aware of, which is why it's so often held up as an example of this is what a brand is like, was actually driven, it actually grew in quite different ways. It grew simply by having enormous energy and ambition and doing lots of different things. There was never a single idea behind it. And over time, even the product changed. I mean, in the early days, it did actually contain, you know, cocaine extract, which were taken out before the First World War, at any rate. So, you know, that's no longer been the case. And it was initially sold as a sort of medicinal thing that would be a pick-me-up. But then they realized they could sell more if they said, well, it's just delicious and refreshing. It's a really nice tasting drink. And then they would push it for all sorts of different usage occasions, and they'd push it for all sorts of different target groups. And the more they added usage occasions, the more they added target audiences, the more, of course, the brand grew and grew. And it just shows you how complex and, you know, multifaceted the history of a brand like this is. And at no point was there this single-minded idea. Now, people will say, ah, yes, but, you know, over time, this must have come in. And I mean, as I say, I used to teach this brand foundations thing, and we'd always take Coca-Cola as example, because everybody was familiar with Coca-Cola, whatever country they came from. Everybody had ideas about it, and everybody had a great time arguing about what the sort of brand essence of Coca-Cola was. And the interesting thing was, everybody came up with different ideas. Is it to do with America? Is it to do with togetherness? Is it to do with refreshment? Is it to do with, you know, family and friends? Is it to do with living life to the full? You know, you can make up hundreds of them, and they all sound good. And actually, that's the strength of Coca-Cola, that it is full of meaning. It's not that it doesn't have meaning. It's packed with meaning. But the meaning is so complex and so various, and it can mean so many different things to different people or in different situations. And that's why it's powerful and strong as a brand. Now, I took Coca-Cola as the example. I could have made exactly the same case for Apple. I could have made exactly the same case for Nike, and at some point I might do this, because, you know, yeah. Nike is one where we continually hear people say, the great secret of Nike is. I mean, I was reading one yesterday, and somebody was going, oh, yes, the point at which Nike went from being a generic sneaker brand to being Nike was when they introduced the line Just Do It, and that this was a massive repositioning of the brand. Now, this is simply not true. Historically, it's nonsense. Just Do It, the line, was invented in 1988. Nike had already been around and been hugely successful for at least 30 years prior to that. I mean, if anything shifted in the 1980s around that time, it was the point where they started thinking, we're not going to aim just at runners. We're actually a fashion brand that's going to aim at everybody. But I mean, if you read it up in the literature, you can easily find the history of Nike. And the final point is that Just Do It, this supposedly repositioning that came from, you know, the great thinking about what the brand onion was going to be or whatever it is, it actually was came up on the spur of the moment. Dan Wyden just thought of it the night before they were due to present the work. They had a whole lot of different ads, and he said, I'd just like there to be one strap line that ties them all together so it looks like a campaign. And everybody else going, no, Dan, we don't need to do that. And he came up with this idea, and he said, how about we just stick Just Do It on the end of it? Just came out of the blue like that. And, you know, of course, it's been a hugely influential line. It's been tremendously valuable for Nike. But, I mean, its power is not that you can translate it back into some abstract idea. Its power is that it is those three words. And those three words, like any work of art, if you like, are so powerful because they can mean so many different things. You try to paraphrase, what does Just Do It mean? If you ask 10 people to do it, you'll get 11 different answers at least. It means such a lot, but none of the paraphrases have anything like the power of Just Do It. So, you know, what we need to do as marketers is stop focusing on what we think is the abstract idea behind something and focus on the thing that is actually there, that is actually making things happen. Now, that for me is a hugely important principle, and it's the fundamental principle that so many marketers and advertising people too completely fail to understand. And they focus on, this is about that, this is the idea behind this. They don't focus on, this is what we're actually looking at. We're looking at a slogan. We're looking at an advertisement. We're looking at a design. We're looking at something tangible. And that's where the power lies.
I suppose part of that problem is that marketers, rather than the marketing team itself, is trying to simplify the process rather than looking at, because it's a bigger question, isn't it? It's a bigger challenge. It's a bigger task. It's at a business level. Everything that you've referenced there, from Coca-Cola, from Nike, from Apple, has been decided at the very top, either by the founder or by the person really leading the business, rather than the marketing team out in a corner trying to pull together a brand onion that oversimplifies everything rather and makes it all sound maybe a little bit easier than it is. And I think this is why I agree with you, and this is why I think we absolutely need to consign this to Marketing Room 101, because I think we're trying to make that process sound easier than it is.
Well, I don't know if it makes it easier. I think it makes it infinitely more complicated. I mean, if when Dan Wyden had come up with this line, just do it, they'd say, and he presented it to the client. The client said, we quite like that line too, Dan, but we can't run with it until we know what the idea is behind it.
Yes.
Can you imagine what would have happened at that point? Well, I'll tell you exactly what would have happened. They would have spent 18 months arguing about what was the idea behind Just Do It. And it would have died completely. So, you know, the problem is you do not make things simple. It's not so much about trying to simplify things. It's about trying to control them. It's about trying to say, we cannot do this until we understand it in a way that somehow we can pin it all down and explain exactly how it works. Now, this is not to say you can't talk about it, make sense of it, and discuss what does this mean. In a practical sense, you know, that'll give you ideas. If it stimulates you, if it gives you thoughts about what I'm going to do next, it's all valuable. But that idea that we can somehow reduce this very rich thing to something that is, you know, very, as you say, very simple, if you like, very, you know, one-dimensional. If you like, say, let's take the Coke bottle, you know, let's analyze the Coke bottle, let's analyze the Nike swoosh, let's take any of these and try and say what they mean. And actually, the whole point is not what they mean. The whole point is they are powerful because they are distinctive and unique, and because they then take on lots of meanings for people. And the longer they last and the more powerful they are, the more meanings they take on. So what you're trying to do in reducing them to a simple meaning or a simple idea is precisely the opposite of what you should be trying to do, which is trying to understand, wow, we've got something really powerful here. What else can we do with it? You know, and you don't need to analyze, just do it. I mean, just fucking do it.
It works.
You know, kind of yes.
If you think, so when you mentioned about the idea of just do it, if we'd have taken a pause at that point and said, actually, no, let's analyze this. Let's spend that 18 months really trying to figure out what does it mean? Do you think that process is that we would maybe do these days is part of a sort of self-consciousness within marketers, where we feel the need to sound more academic, we feel almost an inferiority complex at times, because what we do is it's fun, as opposed to it being something where you need a to be a chartered accountant?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is all those things, but I don't think it's actually new. I think the tendency has been there since about, let's say, since about 1900. And that's a significant date, because that's the sort of start of the kind of business starts taking itself seriously in the States.
Yes.
And advertising starts taking itself seriously. And, you know, business wants to be seen as, you know, sort of honest and above board and professional. And you have books like Frederick Taylor's Scientific Management. And a bit later, you have Hopkins' Scientific Advertising. And some of this is good, obviously, but it's about wanting to be professional. And the point where advertising agencies decided they want to be a profession, they lost something very, very valuable, or they repressed something. And they did not want in the least to be confused with these vulgar entertainers. Whereas a lot of the great people in advertising, like, you know, Peter Marsh, they came from entertainment backgrounds. And, you know, for a long time, they've been treated as something like outsiders in the advertising business, because we do not want to be confused with those vulgar entertainers.
It's a shame, isn't it? Because this is supposed to be fun. You know, we can have fun, and we can make a really great, effective work. We can entertain.
It's fun and it's hard work in the same way that, you know, creating a Pixar movie or putting on a West End show is. You know, they're
absolutely
bloody hard work, bloody complicated. Yeah. Let's not say.
Yeah.
But, you know, the goal is we're going to do something that people experience as fun.
Yeah. So we're going to commit the brand onion to Marketing Room 101 and all of its alternatives, call it a passport, a prism, a brand fruit bowl, whatever we want to call this thing, the brand pineapple. Okay. They're in. They're done. But while you're here, I know we've only got a few minutes left, but while you're here, you have the opportunity, should you like, to remove one thing in its place. So what would you choose if you had one thing that you'd bring back and return to the world of marketing?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's literally two things, but they're kind of manifestations of the same thing. And okay. I'm going to get the guard book and the historical reel. And I mean, the historical reel is literally there on a sort of 35 mil can. And the guard book is a massive, big, you know, ring binder with all the old ads in it. Because I don't believe a brand has an essence. I don't think that statement is meaningful in any useful sense at all. I mean, I think it's a weird platonic idea, which, you know, at a deep philosophical level, it's bollocks. So I don't believe a brand has an essence, but every brand inescapably has something else, which is its own history. And I think that's incredibly important. So, you know, while a brand doesn't have an essence, it is never starting from year zero. It is starting on the basis of everything it's ever done. And actually, without all those things, it wouldn't be what it is today. And within that, there are some really powerful things that need to be, as a general rule, cherished and defended at all costs. Now, because you know your history, you still have choices. You can look at your history and say, we're going to reinterpret something that we did back then for the modern time. And then we make that choice. Like when I worked for Hellmann's mayonnaise back in the early 80s, the whole brand was about special occasions and, you know, dressing up and expensive and so forth. And we did a whole campaign which basically contradicted everything about that. We made it every day. We made it funny. We made it for everyday food. And we trebled sales of Hellmann's within 18 months. You know, I mean, actually, what should be driving a brand is not what's in the brand onion or what's in the brand key. It's like, what's going to enable us to actually sell some more stuff and make some more money over the next 18 months?
Yeah. Now, that final point's interesting. You mentioned Hellmann's because I can't remember if it was the CEO where someone said recently, the purpose of Hellmann's is salads and sandwiches. And I thought, actually, you did just that return to common sense. It's there is no greater purpose for mayonnaise. I mean, we could try and create one, but actually it's no more complicated than that. You don't need the onion there.
You don't need the onion. On the other hand, if you have an idea that says food waste is an issue, we can sell more Hellmann's by saying this is a good way of avoiding food waste, and you make an entertaining campaign out of it, do that. There's no reason not to do that. It's not what the brand's about. It's what you are doing in order to sell stuff.
I think that's a perfect place to finish on that note. Paul, thank you very much for visiting me today in Marketing Room 101.
Well, thank you. It's been great fun.
So you're leaving me the onion and all its variants, and you are taking with you the historical reel and the guard book and distributing them throughout the industry as you go.
Thank you so much, Ben.
So there was my conversation in the depths of Marketing Room 101 with Paul Feldwick. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out his books, Anatomy of Humbug and Why Does the Peddler Sing? And if you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. If you've really enjoyed it, please share it with other people. And if you've hated it, please remain silent and don't tell anyone outside of your immediate family. This podcast is not sponsored by Principals Agency. If it was, it would be produced to a satisfactory standard. However, as they are my employer and they do give me a free day off every week to do things like this, I think it's only right if I give them a quick plug. Principals is the longest running brand comms agency in Leeds, and we create, activate and build unforgettable brands that come to mind quicker and stay there longer. We do this using a set of principles the team and I developed. If you want to find out more, please drop me a message on LinkedIn or head to principalsagency.co.uk.
Thank you, and bye-bye.